Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and it is Kids Open Forum this hour. Any question from any kid is welcome. 888-318-7884. Just get permission to dial that phone and then dial 888-318-7884. Maybe there's something you always wanted to know about Jesus or Mary or the apostles or
the Bible.
Maybe there's
the church.
Keep going, Jimmy. What else we got?
Lots of other
Bigfoot.
Stuff. Yeah. Bigfoot. Loch Ness Monster.
Loch Ness Monster. So
if you're a kid, like, what if you're a kid at heart, you know?
No, I got in trouble for saying that one time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I said, if you're a kid at heart, and then, some older, it sounded like young men, not really old. We started calling, and Marie was like, no, I can't. It's just a kid's hour. And then they gave Marie a hard time.
Oh.
I got in trouble with
So Marie. I could not call.
No, because you are a kid at heart. That is true. And I think it's good to be a kid at heart.
Yeah.
I would probably.
So 18 and under.
Yeah, 18 and under. Right. 888-318-7884. I mentioned Bigfoot. And so that gives me the opportunity to mention your podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah.
Where you have talked about Bigfoot.
Have talked about Bigfoot.
As a matter of fact. All right. So the question I never hear answered about Bigfoot is. All right, so exactly how big is the foot?
Typically, Bigfoot tracks, you know, the like plaster casts that people have made of them, indicate that they're about 18 inches long. It varies and seems to follow a normal distribution or what's also known as a bell curve, but about 18 inches.
Wow, now, that is a big foot.
Yeah.
That's no joke.
Yeah. Typically, a human foot is, or at least a man's foot, is about a foot, you know, 12 inches. Hence the name.
Really? I think my
a lot of them are.
Really?
A lot of them are. Not all of them. In any event, human feet also follow a normal distribution or bell curve in size. And so if you were making large appendages to put on your feet to hoax Bigfoot prints, they would also follow a normal distribution. So the mere fact Bigfoot tracks follow a normal distribution doesn't count significantly as evidence that Bigfoots are an unknown species.
And you say Bigfoots, not big feet.
It can be both ways.
Oh, all right. 888, you don't have to call about Bigfoot. This is open forum. If you have any question about the church, sacraments, any of it, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Already, look at that, Jimmy.
Hey.
Line's lighting up.
Awesome.
We better go to Stephanie in Minnesota. Stephanie, are you there with us?
Talk. Yeah.
Hi, Stephanie. How old are you?
Six.
Well,
I mean seven.
Seven. Oh,
cool.
So you had a birthday then?
I think she's had seven of them.
Stephanie, what is your question for Mr. Akin?
If God is everywhere and Jesus is God, when Jesus became a man, was he still everywhere?
So Jesus is both God and man, and he therefore has what people say are two natures. He has a divine nature because he's God, and he has a human nature because he's man. His divine nature was everywhere at all times, in every time and place there is. God is there. And so in his divine nature, Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, who we know on earth as Jesus, is everywhere and every when. He's in every time also. But his human nature is not everywhere. His human nature came into being about 2,000 years ago. So it's not every when. His human nature is only for the last 2,000 years so far. And it's only in certain places. When he was on earth in his ministry, when he was going around with the apostles, his human nature was only one in one place at a time. But God can do miracles and cause a human nature to appear in many places at one time. And that's what's happening now in the Eucharist, because the Eucharist is in many places, and the Eucharist is the body and blood of Jesus together with his soul and divinity. And so that means that today, Jesus's human nature is not only in heaven, it's also present in many places here on earth as a kind of special miracle. It's not present everywhere, though. It's still only present in heaven and in the Eucharist, but his divine nature is present everywhere today, just like it was before the incarnation and during his earthly lifetime and now as well.
Does that help you, Stephanie?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, Stephanie, that was a great pleasure. We appreciate that call.
It's a very subtle question, too.
It is a very subtle question. And I know she did your favorite thing. She just got straight to her question.
She just asked the question yeah. without telling me all the prehistory of why she wants
right,
to know it.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Kids are great that way.
They are. Stephanie, thank you again for your call. We go now to Lucas in Virginia. Lucas, are you there with us?
Hello.
Hello, Lucas. How old are you?
I'm 13.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Lucas. What is your question for Mr. Aiken?
My question is, why do you think that some people don't associate Catholicism with Christianity, even though Catholicism was basically the first form of Christianity?
This is something that it only exists in recent centuries. This is not something that anyone would have ever heard of before the 1500s. For the first 1500 years of church history, everybody recognized that Catholics are Christians. In fact, if someone had said Catholics are not Christians, they wouldn't have known what you meant because, as you say, Catholicism is the first form of Christianity. But what happened in the early 1500s was the Protestant Reformation began. And at the time in Europe, it was universally recognized that the Catholic Church is the true church. It's the bride of Christ. And so you really need to be part of the Catholic Church. And that meant that the early Protestant reformers, you know, Martin Luther and John Calvin and people like that, they had a problem in convincing people to not be Catholic. They needed to have some kind of alternative story that they could tell about what the Catholic Church is if it's not the bride of Christ, the true church that you need to be part of. And what they did was they took an image from the Book of Revelation of the Whore of Babylon, which is like a big evil thing, and said, okay, the Catholic Church isn't the bride of Christ, it's the Whore of Babylon. And that could explain why it's so big and why so many people think it's the true church, even though they claimed it wasn't. And so it then, from there, became easy for them and in a way necessary for them to say, okay, or for some Protestants to say, if the Catholic Church is the Whore of Babylon, then it must not be Christian at all. And so you started to get Protestants who would say Catholics are not Christians and things like that. Now, it took a while for that to develop. Not the early Protestant reformers didn't say Catholics weren't Christians, but some later Protestants did. And it was basically part of the narrative that they needed to – or the story that they needed to tell to help convince people not to be Catholic. And so over the course of time in English, a lot of English-speaking Protestants have lost an awareness of the fact that the original Christians were Catholics and they view the Catholic Church as this other thing, and some of them still view it as not a Christian church, and therefore they make this distinction between Catholics and Christians. Fortunately, in recent years, over the course of the 20th century, a lot of the kind of hostility that existed between Protestants and Catholics started to cool down. And so today, many, many, many Protestants, most Protestants, would be perfectly happy to say Catholics are fellow Christians. And that's a great thing that they're able to honor us as brothers in Christ the way we honor them as brothers in Christ as well. But unfortunately, there are still some Protestants who want to say Catholics are not Christians, and therefore they're kind of maintaining some of the language that came out of the Reformation.
Okay, Lucas? Okay. Yeah. All right. Very good. Thank you, Lucas. Thanks very much for your call. It is a kids open forum today. If you're a kid and you got permission to dial the phone, 888-318-7884.
We need some more kids to dial the phone because we don't have that many on the line right now.
Yeah, we got about four lines open at the moment. So this would be a good time to dial if you are a kid and you got a question. 888-318-7884. Just make sure you got permission, and we'd love to talk with you. Hey, we got a brand new free book for folks. If you visit the Catholic Answers Facebook page, you can download your free copy of Making the Most of Lent, a Spiritual Companion. Free ebook for you over at the Catholic Answers Facebook page.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
It's the start of a new day and a new year for Morning Glory.
What are you listening to when you get ready to get the kids to school? What are you listening to on that drive in that's going to wake up your spirit and begin your day focusing and thinking about the faith?
You're going to know you're listening to people that care about what you're doing. We want you to get to heaven too. We all want to get there together and we can have fun doing it.
So it's like your morning cup of coffee for your soul.
Me included.
Yeah, absolutely.
Deacon Harold Burke Sivers joins Gloria Purvis and the Morning Glory team Monday, January 14th on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live, Kids Open Forum this hour. If you're a kid, we'd love to take your call. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Now we go to somewhere here in California to Blessed. Did I say your name right? Is it Blessed?
It could be Blessed.
Blessed.
Blessed. Okay, Blessed. And how old are you?
12.
All right. And what is your question for Mr. Aiken?
My question is, does Adam and Eve have a belly button?
Well, it's a very interesting question. A lot of people have wondered about that because the way Genesis depicts Adam and Eve coming to be, God makes Adam's body from the ground directly, the way it's presented to us, and then he makes Eve from Adam. And so neither one of them, if you don't know anything else, neither one of them would have been in a womb previously. So they wouldn't have had an umbilical cord that attached them to their mother. And that makes people wonder, would they have had belly buttons if they didn't have that umbilical cord attaching them? Well, if our belly button was simply like a scar from when the umbilical cord is detached, then they might not have had belly buttons. However, my understanding is that belly buttons are not just a scar. They are something that's built into us on the level of our genes.
Oh.
So each individual cell in our genes has the blueprints for a human body, and those blueprints contain a blueprint for the belly button. So it's not just a scar. If you notice, your belly button doesn't look like other scars. If you've ever cut yourself and got a scar, like I did when I was a kid many times.
Are you scarred?
I have several notable scars from childhood.
Oh.
I slipped repeatedly and broke my chin open on the sink. And so I have a scar under my beard. I also fell out of my bunk bed and hit my head on an oak dresser. And so a tooth went through my lip. And so I have a mustache. And I was reaching to play with a broom next to my grandmother's refrigerator. And it was a hot Houston summer day, and a Coke bottle exploded and gave me a scar on my knee.
Oh, my
so
gosh.
I have several scars. But if you ever look at a scar, that you have, you'll notice it doesn't look like your belly button. And so that seems to be because belly buttons aren't just scars. They're actually something that's built into our genes. And so since Adam and Eve, even if they didn't have mothers, would have had genes that were human, Adam and Eve would have belly buttons. Now, there's also something else. Even though the Bible depicts Adam being made from the ground and it doesn't mention were there any stages that God used there. Today, based on things we know from science, many theologians, many people who study God's word, think that the Bible is, when it says God made Adam's body from the earth, it's affirming that Adam does have an earthly body, but they think there are probably other stages in there where God used the process of evolution as how he produced Adam's body. And so if that's the case, then Adam would have had a mother who was not exactly a human, but almost a human. And in that case, Adam would have had an umbilical cord that attached him to his mother. So even if belly buttons were scars, Adam also would have had a belly button on that view.
Blessed. How's that answer? Was that answer good for you? All right. Well, thank you very, very much. We're very happy you called. I hope you'll call again. It is Kids Open Forum today. Any question from any kid is welcome on any part of our Catholic faith. We go now to Penny in Nebraska. Penny, are you there? Hello, Penny in Nebraska.
Hello.
Hello, Penny. How old are you?
Seven.
Penny, what is your question for Mr. Aiken?
Why did he put Jesus on the cross in front of the church? And why did he put the red thing over him on Christmas?
Okay, so why is Jesus on the cross in the front of the church? And then they cover it with a red thing at Christmas.
Okay. Well, in the reason that Jesus is on the cross in church is so we can remember him better. You could just have a cross, and that would help us remember what Jesus did for us on the cross. But by putting a picture of his body on the cross, that makes it even easier to remember Jesus, and it makes it more, it makes more of an impression on us, and so it makes it more real to us because we see more of what happened if you put Jesus's body on the cross as opposed to just having a bare cross. So that's the reason that Jesus's body is on the cross in church, and other places too. I'm not familiar with parishes putting a red cloth over Jesus's body at Christmas. I am familiar with during Holy Week them putting a purple cloth over Jesus at certain times. And the reason for that is so that when Easter comes, that cloth is taken away and you can see Jesus again, just like when he rose from the dead and so forth.
So we have Jesus on the cross to help us remember what Jesus did. Okay, Penny?
Okay.
All right. Thank you for that call, Penny. Thank you very, very much. Let's go to Mitchell in Illinois. Mitchell, are you there with us?
Hello?
Hello, Mitchell. How old are you?
I'm 11 years old.
Well, thank you for calling us, Mitchell. What is your question for Mr. Aiken?
My question is, when Jesus was alive, did some people think that the people did a wrong choice to crucify him?
Yes. Some people did think that Jesus should not have been crucified. He was very popular in Jerusalem and in other places in the Holy Land, and many people regarded him as a true prophet. And the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, even talk about how there were people who had different opinions about Jesus. Some thought that he was misleading the people, but others thought, no, he's a good man, and many thought he's a genuine prophet of God. And so there was this difference of opinion among people. And obviously Jesus' own followers, like the 12 apostles and the women who traveled with Jesus, they all were supporters of Jesus, except for Judas, you know. And so they all didn't think that Jesus should be crucified. But enough people in key places, like the high priest Caiaphas and some of his friends, enough people who had power thought Jesus should be crucified that they were able to get this done, even though many people thought Jesus should not be crucified.
Okay, Mitchell.
Okay, that makes so much more sense.
Good.
Oh, very good. Mitchell, thank you very, very much for that call. 888-318-7884 is our number here. We've got a line open right now. So if you are a kid and you've got a question about the Catholic Church, the Catholic faith, about God or Jesus or anything like that, you can give us a call, 888-318-7884. Let's go to Jim in Alabama. Hello, Jim. Are you there with us?
Yes.
And how old are you, Jim?
14.
Well, thank you for your call, Jim. What is your question for Mr. Aiken?
Why don't kids have to fast during Lent, but adults do?
There are probably a couple of reasons for this. One of them is kids are still growing and they have special needs. They need to consume more calories so that they can fuel their growth. They need to have extra nutrients so they can, you know, build bones and muscle and organs and things like that as they're growing. And so historically in the past, there was a lot more fasting. Now today it's just 2 days. And so today a lot of kids actually could fast. And, you know, if you eat a little bit less on a few days, it's not going to be a big deal. But historically, there was a lot more fasting that people did. It was much more frequent than it is today. And if you had a kid who was growing and he did a lot of fasting, that could hurt his growth. And so to avoid hurting their growth is probably one of the reasons that children who, you know, anyone who's not 18 years old didn't have to fast. Also, there's another reason, which is children below a certain age wouldn't understand the practice of fasting. They wouldn't understand its purpose, which is to help us grow closer to God. You know, you can imagine a baby. Let's suppose you have a baby whose mom decides, okay, you're maybe 3 months old, but you're gonna fast today, and she won't nurse him. Well, the baby is totally not going to understand that.
That's like the worst day a baby could have.
Yeah, exactly. So the baby's going to be really hungry. The baby's going to be really cranky. The baby's going to start yelling and crying and carrying on because the baby, quite understandably, has no idea what this fasting thing is all about. All the baby knows is I'm not getting fed and I'm hungry. And so, children below a certain age wouldn't understand the practice or wouldn't understand it fully or might not have the self-control that an adult has that enables the adult to eat or to refrain from eating, although a lot of adults need to develop that self-control and who, you know.
I'm working on
it. I'm not looking at you. I'm only looking at you with my eyes. And so for that reason, it was decided that below a certain age, and currently the law says it's 18, you have to be 18 before the law of fast binds you, that below a certain age, it made sense to say, okay, you don't have to fast. Now, you can if you're a kid. Jim, you're 14. You could probably go with, you know, a little bit less food on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday if your parents agree, unless you've got some kind of medical condition that would prevent it. You know, you could do fasting at your age. The fact you're asking the question, you know, suggests you are very thoughtful about this. You would understand how fasting can help you grow closer to God as a form of self-control and self-discipline. In addition to kids not having to fast, at the other end of life, older people can find it difficult to fast too because their bodies are no longer in their prime. And so the requirement of fasting doesn't apply once you turn 69. And so older people, in addition to kids, also don't have to fast, though they can if they're in good physical shape and they want to, as a way of growing closer to God.
Jim, what do you think about that?
That is makes it a lot more helps me understand it a lot more.
Good.
Yeah. You would agree that babies should not be fasting?
Of course.
Jim, yeah. You're all right. All right.
Sensible young man.
Thanks very much for that call. There are lots of folks online, and we are going to get to you. Don't go anywhere. If you have called for Kids Open Forum, we are going to do our very best to get to your call right when we come back. The number is 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and Open Forum means any question at all is welcome. If you want to know something about what Catholics do, what Catholics believe, why we do this stuff, why we believe this stuff, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Don't forget that free ebook is available over on the Catholic Answers Facebook page. The ebook is to help you with Lent. It's called Making the Most of Lent, a Spiritual Companion. Free to you just by visiting our Facebook page.
Catholic Answers Live. We're here for you.
In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it is outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception, using scripture, papal and magisterial teaching, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent put forward a compelling case for Catholic teaching with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging onto the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Author Mark McNeil spent years in the Oneness Pentecostal movement, praying in its lively services, zealously spreading its unconventional teachings, and rejecting mainstream Christianity as misguided. Then he left it all behind. All in the Name is the story of a man who believed he was among an elite group of believers who followed the true faith when so many others had strayed. But an inquisitive mind, careful study, and the action of the Holy Spirit finally led Mark out of Oneness Pentecostalism and into the Catholic Church. This is an inspiring conversion story you won't want to miss. It's a faith strengthener for Catholics and an intriguing challenge to those who deny the doctrine of the Trinity. Order your copy of All in the Name today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Your preferred method of disciplining your children.
We want to hear from you on Monday's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie at noon Eastern.
Now let's get back to more of Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an open forum, but it's for kids. If you're a kid and you got a question, you are welcome to call. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of many things, most recently of a book called Teaching with Authority. If you need help understanding what does the church actually teach and how do I find out what the church actually teaches, this is the book for you. Let us go now to Michael in Nebraska. Michael, are you there with us?
Yes.
Michael, how old are you?
I am 8.
And for some reason, I heard about a guy named Michael in Nebraska who has a brother named Brendan. Is that you, Michael?
Yes.
Yes. Are you amazed that I know that? No,
probably
you are not amazed. Okay, so there was less than amazing. I get it. Michael, what is your question for Mr. Akin?
Is there evidence that Cain repented and went to heaven
after he killed Abel?
The Bible doesn't tell us one way or another. It does record, it does say that after Abel was killed, that God, you know, cast Cain out as a punishment, and Cain then said to God, "My punishment is too much for me because anyone who meets me is going to kill me." And so God put a mark on Cain, like a tattoo on his forehead or something, mm-hmm. so that it was a sign that God was protecting Cain and other people were not to kill him. And that doesn't prove that Cain repented, but it does suggest he may have, if he says this punishment is too much, that's a sign that he may have accepted that he needed to be punished in some degree, which could mean that he accepted that he repented. Also, the fact that God put the mark on him so that he wouldn't be killed would suggest that God had mercy on Cain. It means God did have mercy on Cain because he didn't have to do that. And so as a result of Cain displaying some acceptance of his punishment and of God also showing mercy to Cain, we could, even though the Bible doesn't say he repented and went to heaven, we would have grounds for hoping that he repented and went to heaven.
Okay, Michael?
Okay.
Hey, Michael, while we got you on the phone, maybe your brother Brendan has a question. Can you put Brendan on? See if he's got a question.
How did Cain get Abel to follow him that day if Abel didn't know he was in danger?
Okay. What Genesis says, that's the book of the Bible where this story is found. It's in Genesis 4 if you want to read it or have your parents read it to you. What Genesis 4 says is that Cain said to Abel one day, "Let's go out into the field." Now, at the time, Cain was a farmer, so he had fields where his plants would grow, and Abel was a shepherd, so he had fields where his sheep would be grazing. And so both of them would need to go out and care for things in the fields. Cain would need to go out and care for his plants. Abel would need to go out and care for his sheep. And so they couldn't stay around the house all day. And so according to Genesis 4, one day Cain said to Abel, "Let's go out into the field." We don't know exactly why. He could have meant, "Let's go out and look at my plants," or "Let's go out and look at your sheep," or "Let's go out and look at both of our things," or maybe "Let's just go for a walk." But in any event, he wanted to get Abel away from the house so he could kill him in private, where like Adam and Eve wouldn't see. And so he invited him to go out to the field, and Abel accepted, not realizing what Cain was going to do.
Brendan, I didn't get to ask you how old you are. How old are you, Brendan?
Six.
You're six, you mean. Wow. All right. Well, thank you very much. And will you tell Michael we said thank you for the call, too?
Okay.
Okay, bye, Michael and Brendan.
We have such modest children calling in today. We've had two children who initially identified as one age and then realized they were a year older.
Yeah.
For me, when I was a kid, I really wanted to be the year older. Yeah. I would have even exaggerated slightly. If I was like 6 years and 11 months, I might just say seven.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember saying things like, "I'm six and a half."
Am I the only one in this studio who's concerned about two brothers calling and they want to know about Cain
and Abel
killing Abel? Like, that's all these guys want to know about is Cain killing Abel.
On the Erder May.
But let's go to Penelope in Colorado. I'm sure Penelope has a very, very good question. Penelope, are you there with us?
Yes.
And how old are you, Penelope?
Eight.
And is it cold in Colorado?
Kind of.
All right. Well, thank you for the weather report. What is your question for Mr. Agin?
How come there's a deacon on Sunday Mass, but there's no deacon on any other Mass?
Well, most deacons today that you meet in churches are what are called permanent deacons. That means they're not planning on becoming a priest. And most permanent deacons, because they're not planning on becoming priests, are married and they have jobs just like your mom and dad do. And so they need to go to work on most days of the week. And that can make it hard for them to go to a daily mass. And they, you know, like most people, they have Sundays off. And so they can come to mass on Sunday and serve as a deacon. But most of the other days of the week, they may be at their work earning money for their wife and their children. And so that's why you don't see them as much on weekday masses.
Okay, Penelope.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for that call. I'm glad the answer wasn't you've got a bad deacon.
No.
I was concerned.
And on other days of the week, too, like even on Saturday, they need to spend time with their family.
Yeah.
Even if they're not at work.
Yes. Jonah in Texas, you are up next. Are you there with us, Jonah?
Yes.
Can you ask your dad or mom to turn down the radio there, Jonah? How old are you, Jonah?
Dad, turn down the radio. What?
How old are you?
9.
Well, thank you for calling us, Jonah. What is your question for Mr. Aiken?
Whenever we make the sign of the cross, why do we touch our left shoulder instead of the right?
It's just a matter of custom. You know, people in a given area tend to make the sign of the cross the same way, just because people, you know, tend to copy each other, and it would be a little odd if you stood out and you were crossing yourself by touching your right shoulder first in an area where everyone else touches their left shoulder. But not every place is the same. In the East, in Eastern Christianity, a lot of Christians do it the other way around. They touch their right shoulder first and then their left. And so it's really just a matter of custom of how people do it in a given area. You may find people who attribute a meaning to it, but the real reason is it's a matter of custom, and customs differ from one place to another. Personally, even though, you know, as a Western Christian, I normally touch my left shoulder first, sometimes I'll touch my right shoulder just as a way of honoring Eastern Christians too.
When I look in the mirror, I touch the opposite shoulder.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So your mirror self is Eastern.
I have an Orthodox mirror self, yes. Jonah, is that okay? It's just a custom. That's why we do it.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling from Texas, Jonah.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Elizabeth from Missouri is next. Elizabeth, are you there with us?
Yes.
And how old are you, Elizabeth?
7.
Oh, all right. And you have a question, I gather. Why else would you have called? What is your question for Mr. Aiken?
Why did God choose Mary to be the mother of Jesus?
Well, he chose Mary because she was, at least this is the way, this is a common idea. He chose Mary because she was of the line of David. She was a descendant of David, and he had promised that the Messiah, that Jesus, would be born from the line of David, that Jesus would be a descendant of David. That's why in the Bible, Jesus is called the Son of David. And so since Jesus didn't have a human father, Joseph was just his adoptive father, since Jesus didn't have a human father, it's many people's opinion that Mary must have been a descendant of David, and so that's why she was picked. Beyond that, it's a little hard to say why he picked Mary. We know that Mary was very special. She had, you know, she was immaculately conceived and she was a virgin and things like this, but God may have made her – God did make her special because he had picked her to be Jesus's mother. So in terms of why he picked her, well, we could say because she was a virgin, because he wanted Jesus to be born of a virgin, because Isaiah the prophet had said that, and also because she was from the house of David and he wanted Jesus to be born as a descendant of David because he'd prophesied that too.
Elizabeth, thank you very much for that call.
You're welcome.
All right. I hope we hear from you again sometime, Elizabeth. very relaxed. Elizabeth is very relaxed.
That's good.
I'm like very soothing. We still got this great deal. I imagine we're going to have it for a while, actually, but I hope you'll take advantage of it. During Lent and Easter, sometimes people want to give away a book that maybe invites someone to consider being Catholic, or someone who comes to Mass maybe just on Easter. It's the only time you see them there, and you'd like to give them a copy of something that they could read and might be helpful to them. That's why we've got Trent Horn's book, Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love, on sale by the case. You buy a case of 20, you get them for $3 a copy, which we think is a price that encouraged giving them away. A great way to share the faith this Lent. Visit shop.catholic.com and order your copies.
Have a question? We've got answers.
Catholic Answers.
I love it.
Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Radio, I believe, is the greatest tool for evangelization that the church has today. And I know this because we hear from people all over the world that tell us all the time they came to faith in Christ, in the Catholic Church, through Catholic Radio. Guy that lives right next door to you, he might not ask you about your Catholic faith, but he'll ask us. He'll call in and say, "Tell me about the Catholic Church."
Dr. David Anders thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
I do think Catholic Radio is important. That's why I'm here.
Are you David Anders?
I am not David Anders. No, that.
So you're saying two people think Catholic Radio is important?
At least two. Me and Dr. David Anders.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Good.
And I feel like I'm in good company anytime I'm sharing a view with Dr. David Anders.
Uh-huh.
888-318.
Like maybe watching a sunset or something? Or
I didn't mean a view that way. No, I meant an opinion.
Okay.
I guess.
Okay.
Because he's super
still
smart.
So you wouldn't be good company if you were watching a sunset together?
I don't know. I don't know. What kind of beverages would there be? 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. If you're a kid and you have a question about God or the church or prayer or the sacraments, you're welcome to call. 888.
Got a couple lines open.
Two lines open right now. 888-318-7884. Let's go to Claire now in Ontario, Canada. Are you there with us, Claire?
Hi.
Hi, Claire. How old are you?
Six.
Six? Well, thank you for calling us. What is your question for Mr. Aiken?
My question is, how do you get Jesus up to the cross?
Okay. How do you get Jesus up to the cross? Well, the Bible doesn't tell us exactly. So we have to use what we know about how the Romans often got people to the cross. What they would often do is they would have the pole for the cross already planted in the ground. And then they would take the cross beam and put it on the back of the person who was going to be crucified, and he would have to carry that cross beam to the cross. And then they would nail him to the cross beam and then maybe use like ropes to pull him up and get the cross beam attached to the cross. So that's one way they did it. They didn't always do it that way, but that's maybe how they did it. They might have used ropes to pull Jesus on the cross beam up to the cross, and then they would have nailed his feet as well. On the other hand, what you often see in movies, they may also have done, which is they would have the cross made and all laying down on the ground, and then they would lay the person to be crucified on the cross and nail him to the cross, and then they would use, you know, their arms and maybe ropes to help pull the cross upright and plant it in the ground. So they might have done it that way too, but we really don't know. We do know that at least one unusual thing happened in Jesus's case, which is because it says he started to carry the cross, which may just mean the cross beam, but he had been so hurt by all the whipping that they had done to him, and he was so exhausted that he couldn't carry it. So he stumbled, and they ended up grabbing a man who just happened to be there and had him carry it after Jesus couldn't carry it anymore. So Jesus didn't carry the cross the whole way to where he was going to be crucified. Another man who was named Simon of Cyrene helped him out. And we actually know a little bit more about Simon of Cyrene. So Cyrene is a place in Libya. Mm-hmm. And so he was a man, probably a Jew, who had lived over in Libya but was here in Jerusalem for Passover, major Jewish feast. We also know he had two sons named Alexander and Rufus. And we know that because in the Gospel of Mark, Mark tells his audience that this was Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus. And so the readers of Mark's gospel would have known who Alexander and Rufus was. And it was like, guess what? Their dad was the guy who helped Jesus carry his cross.
Wow. Claire, thanks for that question.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Mario. Mario's in Texas. Are you there with us, Mario?
Hello.
Hello, Mario.
I'm here.
How old are you, Mario?
I'm 15.
Well, thank you for your call, Mario. Your question for Mr. Aiken.
So my question is, so God's all-knowing, right?
Yes.
I mean, yes, at least that's what they teach me.
Mm-hmm. Yep, he is. So,
God's all-knowing, and he knows, so if he put me on earth, he would know if I was going to hell or heaven. Right off the bat, right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, but then it seems kind of contradictory because if God is all-loving, how can he put someone on earth who will, you know, suffer eternal damnation?
Okay.
He knows it, right?
Right. So you're asking a very sophisticated question, and because you're older and because there's no other way to answer this question, I'm going to lay a couple of theological terms on you. I'll explain what they mean, but this is a very subtle question, and to explain it, I need to use a couple of terms. The question has to do with what kind of knowledge God has. According to all theologians, God has at least two types of knowledge. The first type of knowledge is called I can skip the term on this one, but the first kind of knowledge is a kind of knowledge whereby God knows everything that's possible. Okay? So if something's at all possible, like you go to heaven or you go to hell, God knows that's possible. But knowing what's possible isn't the same as knowing what's actual. And so that leads to a second kind of knowledge, which God also has, that's called the knowledge of vision. And by the knowledge of vision, God looks at the world and all of its history and sees everything that's actual, everything that happens, he sees it. And so in addition to knowing everything that's possible, God also knows everything that's actual. So if he makes you in, let's say, the year 2000 or the year 2004, since you're 15, and he makes you in the year 2004, and then he sees your death whenever it is, hopefully 100 years from now or more. He sees whether you're going to die in his friendship or not, and thus he knows from all eternity, will you go to heaven or not? But he knows that because he made you and because you're real. If he didn't make you, if you were only a possibility, then according to this theory, he would know it's possible for you to go to heaven or hell, but he wouldn't know do you actually go to heaven or hell unless he makes you and sees what you do. Now, there are also theologians who say that God has a third kind of knowledge. It's called middle knowledge because it's kind of midway between God's knowledge of what's possible and God's knowledge of what's actual. And in according to middle knowledge, God would know that what a person would do if he created them and put them in certain situations. But it's not a church teaching that God has middle knowledge. According to like St. Thomas Aquinas, he has only two. He has the knowledge of what's possible and the knowledge of what's actual, but he didn't have knowledge of what would happen if he made something. And that's where the real problem comes in, because if God has middle knowledge, then it's harder to see why he would create someone knowing before his decision to create them that they would end up going to hell. That does seem unloving. And so one solution is to say, well, God must not have middle knowledge because it would be a problem. But there are other answers as well. You could say, well, no, God does have middle knowledge and it's still okay for him to create someone knowing that they're going to go to hell because, number one, it's fair. He genuinely gave them a chance to go to heaven and they chose not to. So he's being fair. But also you could argue he's being loving because even people who are in hell, it's better for them to exist than to not exist. And so even though they didn't accept all of the things God wished they would accept, they nevertheless are ending up with a positive experience on balance, that it's still better to exist than to just not exist at all. And so on that idea, God, even if he had middle knowledge, would still be doing something generous for these people, even if they brought some suffering on themselves.
Mario, I hope that was helpful. I'd love to go back to you, but we've got lots of calls, and I want to try to get as many folks in as I can. So let's go to Emmy in Texas. Emmy, are you there with us?
Hello.
Hello, Emmy. How old are you?
10.
And, Emmy, what is your question for Mr. Aiken?
If Jesus did most of his things during Holy Week, why is there 40 days in Lent?
Well, he didn't do most of his things during Holy Week. Holy Week was just 7 days, and Jesus had a ministry that was at least 3.5 years long. So he did a lot of things that weren't in Holy Week. The reason that Lent is based on 40 days, although it's actually a little bit longer than 40 days, the reason is because 40 is a special number in the Bible. Moses was went on the mountain for 40 days. Rain fell for 40 days during the flood. And Jesus himself went into the desert to prepare for his ministry, to fast for 40 days. And it's really primarily Jesus's 40-day fast in the desert that we're basing our custom of Lent on. Although since most of us aren't Jesus, obviously anyone except Jesus himself is not Jesus, we don't fast the whole 40 days the way he did. But that's what Lent is based on, is Jesus's 40-day preparation for his ministry in the desert by fasting. And so that's why it's a little more than 40 days long.
Emmy, I thank you very much for the call. I'm going to keep going because I just don't want to miss anybody. Isabel in Kansas, are you there with us?
That's me. Yes.
Hi, Isabel. How old are you?
9.
And what is your question for Mr. Aiken?
Why do they call the land of God Zion?
Okay. I'm gonna use a Latin phrase to help explain that. There's a figure of speech called pars pro toto, which means the part for the whole. And we often use pars pro toto, or the part for the whole, in when we talk about things. Like if you talk about a ship and you say all hands on deck, well, what you mean is you want all the sailors to come on deck. You don't want just their hands, but you're referring to the sailors by part of their bodies, by their hands. So when you say all hands on deck, you mean all sailors on deck. Well, in the same way, in Jerusalem, there is a special hill named Zion. That's the name of the hill. And since the hill Zion, or Mount Zion, is part of the Holy Land, it became a term for all of the Holy Land. So all of Israel could be referred to in the Bible as Zion based on the part for the whole principle.
Isabel, I hope that was helpful. Maria and Joseph, I'm so sorry we didn't get to you. We tried our best to work through all the calls. We're very grateful. Thank you so much
for
calling.
And they can call in on any open forum, even if it's not just for kids.
Oh, kids are always welcome anytime. Maybe next Tuesday, Maria and Joseph, you can give us a call. In the meantime, Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for a really fun Kids Hour.
Yeah, my pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
Jimmy's podcast is Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You should catch it. It's cool. What's the current one? Is it on Hitler's?
The Phoenix UFO Lights Incident.
Oh, the UFO Lights Incident. That's it for us. Jesus Christ is the light of the nations. And we'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Live.